Hello, I'm Terrence McNally. Welcome to Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'll be joined today by Daniel Goleman, longtime science journalist at the New York Times, best-selling author who made a significant contribution to how we see ourselves when he literally wrote the book on emotional intelligence. His most recent book, co-authored with neuroscientist Richard Davidson, is Altered Traits: Science Reveals How Meditation Changes Your Mind, Brain, and Body. But first, after hosting and producing this show for nearly two decades, in 2014 I stopped recording new live interviews, and the show continued on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn, streaming relevant interviews from the archives. Podcasts are available anytime, anywhere. They go back about 10 years now on iTunes, Podomatic, and at my site. And I'll give you two different sites that are both the same one. TerrenceMcNally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. But then with the election of Donald Trump, I can't resist exploring the path forward in some new interviews. And before I bring Daniel in, let me offer you a few websites for information on how to participate in resisting Trump and in moving past him toward the healthy and just future we all need. You can email me also at temcnally@mac.com to get these websites and more information. Here they are, indivisibleguide.com, probably the most widespread, I think there's 5,000 local organizations, indivisibleguide.com. MoveOn.org, which for many years has been an online activism site, has now made itself much more coordinated with grassroots activism on the ground. MoveOn.org. TownHallProject.com, which tells you when your elected representatives might be holding town halls nearby. OurRevolution.com, which is the organization that grew out of the Bernie Sanders campaign. OurRevolution.com. FiveCalls.org, which sort of gives you the calls that are going to be most relevant and timely that you might make to your representatives. Five calls with the number five. And then CourageCampaign.org in the state of California, like Move On, a longtime online activism site, now coordinating more closely with the grassroots. So this is probably one of the two least political or topical shows that I've done since I began doing new shows this year. The other was with Robert Wright on his book, Why Buddhism is True, and they both share the same central focus, mindfulness and meditation. Why? Well, two reasons. First, I intend even the overtly political interviews to be about more than resistance and to tell the story of the society we want and how to get there. And to me, mindfulness is part of that story. And second, both Robert and Daniel have much to say beyond their current books. They both have looked at society in a wide-ranging way over the years, and so we will tap into some of that. His books, Primal Leadership, Realizing the Power of Emotional Intelligence, and Leadership, the Power of Emotional Intelligence, sound particularly relevant with Trump as president. So we'll talk with Daniel Goleman about whether Trump employs emotional intelligence to attract and influence others without using it emotionally intelligently. And we'll talk about what's going on in a society at large in terms of emotional intelligence. We'll talk about the individual and society potential of mindfulness and get into the useful findings in Altered Traits. And with the enormous growth in awareness and practice of mindfulness and meditation, have come widespread claims of its benefits. What Goleman and Davidson did, they're both longtime meditators. They're both research guys. One is a journalist, one is a research scientist. They examined the scientific research to find out what's true and what is not. A psychologist and science journalist, Daniel Goleman, reported on brain and behavioral research for the New York Times for, I think, 12 years. And apart from his books on emotional intelligence, he's written books on self-deception, creativity, social and emotional learning, transparency, eco-literacy, and the ecological crisis. Welcome again, Daniel Goleman, to Free Forum, a world that just might work.
Terrence, it's a pleasure to be your guest.
Very good. Daniel, I think I've mentioned it before. You and I met in 1968 at Harvard, in a graduate course or seminar, I'm not sure which it was, led by David McClelland on achievement motivation. And I remember most a weekend workshop that brought together McClelland's grad students, PhD candidates. I was one of the few undergrads in that weekend. And what was curious to me, which says a little about how our culture and our diversity in this country has changed, was he also had a number of folks from India, where McClelland was teaching achievement motivation, entrepreneurial, habits and so on to the Indians.
Yeah.
And I suspect that your work in this area of achievement motivation and what was going on in India and so on, may have influenced both your later work on emotional intelligence and your involvement with meditation. And so can you take us down that path a bit? And if you want to start with, what you were doing with McClelland, et cetera.
Well, so McClelland was my main mentor. I was a graduate student when you were an undergrad in those days. And McClelland was a remarkable guy because he was working not only in India, he was also working in Ethiopia, which was even poorer than India in those days, if you can imagine. And what he was trying to do was find people who were natural entrepreneurs or wanted to be. And he was training them to think like an entrepreneur and to behave like an entrepreneur to help them get their businesses started. And he was remarkably successful, according to some follow-up data I saw way back then. But the influence that he had on me was twofold. Not only was it around the achievement motivation, but rather the larger idea that was part of, which is that there are certain competencies that people have that make them stars. And this has been a foundation of my work in emotional intelligence. He was one of the pioneers of something called competence modeling, which organizations use to identify star performers and also what distinguishes them from people who are just mediocre, because they want to hire people that look like stars and promote people for those abilities or help train people. And what I found was that if you look at outstanding leaders, the power of emotional intelligence is remarkable, because the higher in an organization you go, the more emotional intelligence matters. So David really laid the groundwork for that. At the same time, he fronted for me on a Harvard pre-doctoral traveling fellowship, which gave me a total, actually, of 2 years in India, where I started very serious study of meditation, what that kind of mind training could actually do. It was several decades ahead of the current interest, but for me, it was really seminal. So Dave McClelland was a keystone of all of this for me.
Very good. So let's look into the emotional intelligence part first. As I set up in the intro, I think there's a lot going on right now in our contemporary culture that is about. I heard you chuckle a bit when I said, about Trump. Obviously, he's got a knack, and yet he doesn't have an ethic. But we'll get to him in a second. What is emotional intelligence? What are the key elements?
There are four parts. One is self-awareness, knowing what you're feeling, knowing what's driving you, knowing how your emotional state affects your ability to do what you want effectively. The second part is managing those feelings, handling your emotions, particularly stress, so that you're not undone by it, but can still work effectively or do whatever it is your goal is in the moment. Keep your eye on those goals despite all the distractions life brings us. Stay pretty positive going forward. And there's empathy. And here there are three kinds of empathy. Cognitive, knowing what the person you're with thinks and how they think and how to put things so they'll understand it. Emotional, knowing how what you're doing is affecting the other person emotionally. And then emotional concern, which is the basis of real connection. And that may be where our current president is a little lacking. There are the relationship abilities. That's the fourth part. Connecting with people, inspiring them, being part of a team, managing conflict, being able to persuade people. All these are abilities to make people more effective.
Okay. What one thing I actually re-listened to an interview we did on your book Focus a few years ago, and in that you pointed out that a colleague of yours, a friend of yours, had written about emotional intelligence, so that while I was correct saying you wrote the book on it, you weren't the first to use the term. But what brought you to kind of focus on it, and what surprised you in your original studies, your original look into emotional intelligence?
Sure. So actually, it was my friend Peter Salovey, who's now the president of Yale University, who not coined the term. It's been around, it turns out, for decades, but who did a psychological study of emotional intelligence in a very obscure journal. It doesn't exist anymore. But I love the idea that you can be intelligent about emotions. And I use that as the frame of the book I did that everyone knows about, the 95 book, Emotional Intelligence. And as I got more deeply into it, the big surprise for me was that IQ, the ability to do well in school, for example, gets you just so far in once you're out of school. And it turns out, I just saw a study that says that after an IQ of 120 or so, 100 being the norm, it doesn't really help you succeed that much. And that fit very well with what I found when I looked at, remember I talked about confidence modeling, David McClellan had helped start. Turns out that most modern organizations of any size use this competence modeling to determine what makes someone outstanding here. And when you look at those models, which I did after writing Emotional Intelligence, it turns out that cognitively based abilities, like I can do this computer program, I'm good at analytic thinking, work to an extent, but at the higher you go in the organization, the less they matter. And it's really the emotional intelligence abilities that distinguish the outstanding leaders. And I think it makes sense when you realize, well, yeah, you can hire people that have a particular cognitive skill. The trick is to manage them, to persuade them, to inspire them, to handle the conflicts, to know what they need or want, to care about them. Those are the abilities that make a leader outstanding. And those are emotional intelligence abilities.
And you, I don't know if this is the study you're talking about, but in another interview that I listened to, you pointed out that you'd read a recent study that had, that this was true of coders and engineers in the high-tech world where one would think rationality is king.
Yeah, that's funny. I was just talking to a guy who used to be at Google who was elaborating on this. The finding was this. Engineers are asked to evaluate each other as for success, effectiveness, and so on. They know each other really well. These are hard. It's a hard metric. And then their IQ is compared to how they're doing. There's no correlation. So among engineers, it turns out IQ correlates zero with how successful you are as an engineer. What correlates enormously is your emotional intelligence. And my friend at Google confirmed that. He said, everyone there is smart. You have to be in the top 99% or something like that. That's the top 1% of IQ. So it's a given. But what distinguishes people is how well they can persuade, how well they can influence, how well they can be a team player, inspire. In other words, it's the emotional intelligence side of the equation.
Mm-hmm. And this is true also, and I'm just hearing a similarity here. It's true even with athletes. Am I correct? In other words, it seems to me that when you become an elite athlete, your skill levels, everybody's got talent, similar to the coders and so on. But the people who really are a step above, I think emotional intelligence plays a key role.
Well, are you a team player? I just had a discussion with someone who's with the NBA, about how the most emotionally intelligent coaches are able to get the best out of their teams. And one way they do it is by showing that they really care about each player as a person. But another thing, if you think about the guys on the court or women on the court, if it's women's basketball, it's not the one who's going to try the heroic shots all the time and hog the ball. It's the one who's going to be part of a unit, the team, and get that ball down the court and get it into the basket, however that works. So it's really, are you harmonious on a team that makes you the outstanding athlete?
And I think if one looked at the NBA, for example, right now, we had the era of a Kobe Bryant, who I think fit the one who would shoot the hero shot. And in certain situations, it worked great, and in certain situations, it didn't. The Golden State Warriors seemed to be the embodiment of an emotionally intelligent team.
It's interesting that so Kerr, who the coach,
Steve Kerr,
won the NBA championship his first year as a coach. Never in the history of the NBA had a first year coach won. I got a call from someone in his organization saying, "You know, the reason we did is Steve Kerr has a lot of emotional intelligence in how he manages the team."
I thoroughly believe that. And just watching the guy, you get that feeling. Very interesting. So we've laid out the enormous asset that emotional intelligence is. So a couple of questions. How innate is it? How much is it a learnable skill? And how much are we teaching it nowadays?
You know, genes are overrated. Nature and nurture. I was just talking to the guy who's actually the CEO of Aetna Insurance. It turns out to be a very caring guy. I was impressed by him. But he said, we have data at Aetna that shows that your zip code is more important than your genetic code in your health. And what he meant was, he unpacked it. He said, genetics is about 30%. How you handle your health, how you manage your life, is 60%, and that varies by zip code. And the health care you get is 10% of outcome. I thought that is really amazing. But anyway, with emotional intelligence, we're born with different, neurotransmitter set points and so on. All of that is valuable. It's called epigenetics. It's how we live our lives, the habits we acquire, the abilities we have that help us manage our genes and manage our lives. So I would tip it toward nurture over nature.
Mm-hmm. And so then in terms of teaching, and I'm going to lay this one out a couple of ways. One is, obviously, in 95, when you wrote the book, though the term had been around for decades, and, obviously humanistic psychology had been around for decades and so on. But up until that point, I doubt there were many people teaching it. So we're saying it's learnable.
Well,
how are we doing it that? Yeah, go ahead.
Well, in fact, emotional intelligence, the book, was an argument for teaching this in schools, for helping kids acquire the best emotional intelligence they could, along with math, along with English, and so on. And now there are maybe thousands or tens of thousands of schools that include some component of what's called SEL, social emotional learning, in what they're offering students. And the one reason is it helps kids do better in school. It turns out that if you, they did a meta-analysis, an aggregate of studies of schools that had the program and those that didn't. It had about 270,000 students in it. It was a massive meta-analysis. And it showed if you're in a school with teaches emotional intelligence, basically, antisocial acts, bullying, fights, and so on, go down 10% more in the schools that need it the most. Pro-social, liking school, wanting to go to school, feeling someone cares about you, up 10%. And then academic achievement scores rose 11%. In other words, it helps you learn. And I think it's a win-win for schools because kids are better behaved in class. They manage themselves better. Teachers have to spend less time just getting kids' attention. And kids are retaining more of what's happening in the class and what they read in their books. So I think it's actually quite successful.
You know, one thing that as you were saying that, what struck me was that one of the things you finally said, which is that the teacher has to exert less time, less energy, and probably less stress managing behavior. And having been, I started out as a school teacher, and when I substitute taught on those times when I did that, you know, if you could get over that hump with them, then things flowed. But if it was all about behavior the whole time, nothing happened. And someone who goes into teaching who really wants to impart knowledge, they will be, I think that there will be a cumulative negative to that teacher when he finds, oh, I can't get into that good stuff I thought about last night. I can't, I'm not reaching them, and so on.
It's interesting. Teachers have become those enthusiastic agents for change to bring this in, because not only do kids pay more attention, it helps them with their stress. You know, teaching, like nursing, is one of those professions which is undervalued, underpaid, and overstressed. It has a lot, high burnout rate. But if the kids, the students, are more attentive, better behaved, and if you're picking up some of these skills, how to metabolize stress better, you're going to enjoy what you do and stay with it, and the kids are going to benefit too.
Yeah, I mean, the long-term benefit of a good teacher who doesn't burn out is just fun. I mean, you know, you think of the ripple effects of that.
And also just the practical costs.
Yeah,
it costs a lot of money to find someone new, to train someone new, and this is true with any kind of turnover. If it's a business or a school, doesn't matter.
That's right. That's, I think, where you go back to how, I mean, we haven't talked that much about it, but you mentioned it with the Aetna fellow. But emotional intelligence really caught on in business, and it strikes me that you're exactly that. Last thing you pointed out is probably enormously important: the amount of money that corporations have to spend to replace and train and teach history and so on to someone, compared to people who enjoy being where they are because the culture there includes enough emotional intelligence that they feel belonging, they feel part of a team, etc.
Exactly.
If we wanted to increase the teaching of social emotional learning, are there organizations that one could look to? If someone's listening to this and says, wow, my kid's school could use that.
There's an organization called the Collaborative for Academic Social Emotional Learning. They have a website, CASEL.org. And if you want to bring this into your own school, one of the things about the States, is, as opposed to other countries, is that all of the decisions about what to teach are bottom-up. They're local decisions, city by city, district by district. So if this program isn't in your child's school, go to CASEL.org.
I'm going to say that again, because actually your voice broke up right then. C-A-S as in Sam, or social, E-L. So it's the Collaborative Association for Social Emotional Learning, CASEL.org. One last note on this. What's the age that it sort of has the most leverage?
You know, the programs are age appropriate, kindergarten through 12th grade. And I would say the earlier years lay the foundation for the later years. So the earlier you can get this into a child's life and learning, the better. But I would say we can learn at any age. That's the good news, by the way, for emotional intelligence in working life, in leadership.
Mm-hmm. And I did hear one interview, however, where you mentioned, where you talked about middle school. Middle school being that point where a child's belonging, a child suddenly... school becomes so much. It's where that focus, I think a young child, their emotions really are wrapped up in family. About middle school, they start being wrapped up in their peers. And if they can get that that learning then, you know, that's another.
Yeah, I'll go with that too. That's another key period. Puberty, when you leave elementary school and go to middle school, all of a sudden there's a shift. Before, as you said, it's your family that looms so large. Now it's your friends, as any parent will tell you. And that's why it's all the better if you and everyone you're friendly with is getting lessons in, you know, how to empathize instead of bully.
And how to be a friend.
How to be a good friend. You have an even better experience of those years.
Very good. Okay, let's move to that question I raised in the introduction about Donald Trump. And it strikes me that Donald Trump utilizes a certain savant-like emotional intelligence to grab and hold attention and obviously in sufficient numbers and sufficient passion to be elected president. But I said, it seems he missed the emotional intelligent part where you would use it emotionally intelligently. I'm sure you've done a bit of thinking about...
So let's look a little more carefully at what emotional intelligence is. It's self-awareness and self-management. I would say he doesn't do very well there.
That's right.
I would say that his savant-like ability has to do with communication and empathy. He empathizes with the people that he speaks to, his core audience, if you will. And he is able to say what they want to hear because he knows how they're thinking and how they're feeling. I don't think he has that third kind of empathy, which is actual caring, because he doesn't seem to implement policies that help that very constituency in their work lives or in their health lives or in their lives.
Or we even see it in the phone call with the widow, et cetera, that he just
doesn't. Yeah, he was very off.
Yeah.
Very off. He's quite uneven, I would say. He's brilliant at some things and really deplorable in others.
So that thing that you talked about where he has a sort of a gut understanding, which I would think is any great salesman, whether they actually have concern or caring, they've got something. And that self, that ability to know what someone wants to hear, it's somehow related to emotional intelligence, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. It's part of emotional intelligence to know how the person you're with is thinking. That's that cognitive empathy, to know what's going to move them, what they're going to like, what they're going to dislike. That's the emotional empathy. The third part, which is empathic concern or caring or connection, I think that that's where he maybe is not so good. And in fact, the first two are what marketing, persuasion, and salesmanship is all about, but that may mean you're selling something that's not really for that person's best interest.
Right. Let me tell people, by the way, this is Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work, on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn. And for this week's conversation and many other interviews, articles, transcripts, and so on, you can go to my website, terrencemcnally.net. The podcasts go back to about 2008, actually. terrencemcnally.net, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. And if you want to get my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on and what we're going to talk about, and usually about 6-7 articles that are relevant to the topic or the moment, email me at temcnally@mac.com. And you can also subscribe and listen to the podcast on iTunes. And you can follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence. What about if you take that emotional intelligence lens and look at our larger society and the way that we are communicating with each other, the way we're not communicating with each other, the way we're seeing so many of our neighbors or fellow citizens as the other. What are some of your thoughts about not just Donald Trump, but society at large that gives rise to a Donald Trump and creates enough, passion about someone like that, that he could be president? What do you see going on in society in these terms?
You know, I think it's interesting because the rise of the other in American public discourse is really striking. The fact that whether you're on the left or the right, the other folks over there look strange, crazy, deluded. And this is, I think it runs both ways. And I think partly that may be an artifact of new technologies of communication. When I was younger, everybody watched the news. There were three versions of the news, CBS, ABC, and NBC, but it was basically the news. And everybody watched the same programs on TV, the sitcoms. There was a kind of commonality of understanding and made a kind of a village feeling, even for people from far-flung places. As we've gone more into the internet, niche communications, I think we've become more balkanized, and that helps the other because there's less chance to empathize, less chance to hear how other people think. It's interesting, the New York Times just initiated the invitation to people who support Donald Trump to write poetry about why they support him. And it's actually a great service to people who tend to be progressives, Times readers, who don't know anything about how those folks, those others are thinking. And I think that the more of that cross the gap communication we can have, the better it will be. And the less we have, I think the worse it will be.
Yeah, I happened to see Arlie Hochschild speak this past weekend, who wrote Strangers in Their Own Land.
Sure.
The book in which she goes down and spends quite a bit of time in Louisiana, in refinery country and chemical country and Trump country and post-Katrina country. And it was powerful when she would talk about how she would get beyond, you know, she being a pointy-headed, liberal from Berkeley. And it just strikes me, one of the things she said she did was she often did her interviews while fishing. She said,
there you go.
It did two things. One, you're on their turf, you know. The fellow you're interviewing is the better fisherman. He knows the area. That's good. Two, you can't go anywhere. You can't be distracted. Pretty, I thought of
that. Yeah, that's right. That's brilliant. I love that.
Yeah. Let's shift gears to meditation, mindfulness, the subject of this book. So we... In one of the earliest answers, you talked about how you did some research work in India, which allowed you really to do the research work you were doing for yourself,
right,
which was in meditation. How did that happen? What did you find? What did you, you know, how aware were you before you went over? Was it just a flavor you tried a couple of times and you were going, you know, I'm going to see what it's like to eat this every day? What was your intention and what happened?
Sure. So as I said, David McClellan gallantly fronted for me and got me a traveling fellowship to go to India while I was a graduate student. And while I was there, I was interested in meditation and particularly what happens if you do this really seriously for a long, long time, like all your life. And in Asia, in India, you can find people who basically are professional practitioners, professional meditators. They're called monks, nuns, and yogis. And that's a culture that supports them, that sees the value of that, so unlike our own. So I had done meditation as an undergraduate, really, I think, because I was anxious, and it helped me calm down and focus. But when I got to India, I saw people that were at the high end, you know, who were, had done this all their lives, who were very different. They were very present. They were not focused on themselves, but about you, on you when you're with them. They had, you know, you really felt unconditionally loved. It was quite remarkable. And I was studying clinical psychology at Harvard, which is the exact opposite. It's about how to tell what's wrong with the person you're with. And this was all about what could be right. So when I got back to Harvard, I said, you know, meditation seems to do something that makes people, puts people in this positive register, and we don't know anything about it. And they didn't seem to want to know anything about it at that time. It was too early. But I did my research on meditation, as did my co-author, Richard Davidson, who's now a neuroscientist at the University of Wisconsin. He was a fellow graduate student. We both did. And it was very early. At that time, there were like three published studies we could cite. Now there are, when we did our book, there were more than 6,000 that we sifted through to find the 60 that were really tight.
Okay. And you then came back and did your thesis on meditation, yes?
I did. And I looked at how meditation could help you handle stress better. And as I point out in the book, the way I did it, that study, which was published in an APA journal, a peer-reviewed journal back then, would not have made the cut for the book we did, nor would Davidson's dissertation.
Let me, in case someone's sort of casually listening, what you just said is that the study that you did your thesis on and Davidson's early studies, when you went back and reviewed, you'd have said, those aren't good enough.
Yeah, exactly. We didn't have the right control groups. We didn't. There are many, many different reasons. But what that does say is that the 60 studies we found are very rigorous, and they're in the best journals, and they're kind of bulletproof. And what they show is that meditation from the start has remarkable benefits. For example, if you're just starting mindfulness, there's new popularity in one kind of meditation, which is the ability to be present moment to moment to your own experience without judging it or reacting to it, simply noting it. That may sound very simple, but try it for a minute. Try to be mindful of your breath, just watching every in-breath and every out-breath and so on. And your mind's going to wander off. That's the way the mind is wired. And you need to notice it wanders and bring it back. That's part of it's the mental workout. It's like a rep with a weight in a gym. Every time you bring it back, you're strengthening the circuits for focusing, for concentration, for being present. And the net benefits are actually kind of remarkable. One is when it comes to being really busy and multitasking, as we all are, if you're focused on that one important thing you have to do today and you're really concentrated, then you think, oh, I should check my email or my texts or Twitter or, Facebook, and, you wander off and then you come back to that thing. Generally, your concentration is much lower now when you get back to it, unless you did mindfulness that day, in which case it stays pretty high. So the ability to sustain concentration is improved. The ability to learn is improved. It turned out when they taught mindfulness to students at the University of California, compared to others who didn't do it, they got a 16%, 16 points higher score on the graduate school entrance exam, the GRE.
Whoa! That could change their life.
Exactly. That's the difference between, Caltech and, the JC or whatever.
Yeah.
Anyway, so those are real benefits. And also, I looked at stress, and it turns out I was right. It does help you recover more quickly from stress. Not only recover more quickly, but be less triggered, less often and less strongly. So, and I think in today's climate, with all the news that's upsetting coming incessantly, this is really important because it's the ability to recover and to get back to baseline. When we're upset, we don't think as well as we do when we're calm. Then we're clear. So I think that not only does stress recovery help you physiologically, and it does, but it helps you have more clarity about what to do now. And this actually reminds me of a book I did. The new book is called Altered Traits. It's about meditation. The book before was for the Dalai Lama's 80th birthday. It's called A Force for Good. And what he says is he encourages people to find a way to be composed and clear so you can understand problems deeply and come up with solutions that you can enact. He says there are three steps. First, inner composure. Second, caring. Thinking about what you can do that's for the greater good, not just for me. And then third, finding whatever skills or abilities or position you have use toward that end and get going, acting now. And I think actually, Terrence, you're saying the same thing in other terms.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And talk a little bit about your work with the Dalai Lama, because that isn't the first thing you've done. It's part of some sort of an ongoing collaboration you're doing.
Yeah, I just stepped down as the oldest board member of a group called the Mind and Life Institute, which for 30 years has been putting together dialogues between the Dalai Lama and groups of scientists. And I've organized quite a few of those and still am taking part. One of them was on the topic of destructive emotions, when emotions become destructive. And during that dialogue, Richard Davidson was a participant. He looked right at Davidson. He said, You know, my tradition has many methods for handling emotions well, disturbing emotions. Take them out of the traditional context, bring them to the lab, study them rigorously, and if you find them a benefit, spread them as widely as you can. That really gave birth to the whole field of contemplative science, which is what we're harvesting in the book Altered Traits. So, you know, the two are very related. The Dalai Lama has been one of the biggest proponents of looking at meditation research in terms of, well, what are the general benefits? How could this help humanity?
And what you've been talking about so far are benefits then that you can get how quickly?
The two I mentioned, the better focus and learning better and so on, come right at the beginning. That's and by beginning, I mean, you know, maybe after an introductory course where you might have done 25 to 30 hours total, you start to find changes that show up in the brain, that show up in mental function, in cognitive ability. If you do that with a compassion or caring meditation, people become more generous, more likely to help others in need, not turning away from suffering, but staying with it and caring about the person, wanting to do something about it. So they become more generous, more likely to actually help. And I think that's really important in this day and age, too.
Let me jump in on that one just for a second, because that meditation, the meditation of loving kindness and loving compassion, for folks who have tried to work with a mantra or work with your breath, and you get distracted too easily and you've given up, it was frustrating. The cool thing about metta is you're actually meditating while you're, in some sense, I mean, doing something.
Yeah. Let me translate. Metta, the term metta is actually from the Pali language, and it means loving kindness or compassion. And the meditation there, the practice, the mental exercise, actually is repeating phrases. And people may find it easier than watching their breath.
That's what I'm saying.
A mantra, because it occupies your mind. And it occupies your mind with something very positive, which is, you know, wishing other people well, wishing yourself, people who have been kind to you, people you love, people you know, strangers, everybody. You know, that they have a life that's flourishing, that they'd be well, happy, and so on. And that turns out to be a psychoactive substance, doing that like every day. And it strengthens interesting circuitry in the brain. It's the neural circuitry that we share with mammals, parental caretaking. It's a parent's love for a child. So what you're doing is feeling that loving intent toward anybody and everybody eventually. That's the goal. Not that you can do that right off the get-go, but the more you do that, it also turns out to activate your own circuits for happiness. It feels good to care about others, which is maybe a little-known secret about compassion, but it's important.
But so, people, if you want to look into that one, I'm sure you could Google Metta, M-E-T-T-A, and for those of you...
Or loving kindness. There's a new group, a nonprofit I just heard about called Cultivating Compassion, CCT. I don't know what the T is, but it was a version of this for anybody. It's not in its original spiritual context, but a lay version. It was developed at Stanford University and is now being presented as a program for anyone interested.
Okay. And also, I would say Sharon Salzberg, who I've had on the show more than once, has a book on loving kindness and so on. So, we've sort of laid it out that if for you it would be easy to go, may you be healthy, than to just go to your breath, check it out. Now, one of the keys to... I did want to talk about... set this up with my own experience, which is that I was introduced to meditation in 71, so pretty contemporaneous with yourself. And here's the quick story. I answered an ad in the Boston Phoenix, which was our alternative newspaper, and what it was a group of people who wanted to buy a sailing ship and sail around the world. And I had just I graduated in 69 in social relations, which is the same I believe
same department, yeah.
The same department, which no longer exists, sadly. And so my girlfriend and I both joined this group of a dozen people. We bought a ship and we started sailing. And when we bought it down in the West Indies, we sailed it up. There's a, you know, months go by, but when we finally head out to we're heading to Nassau, I said, "Well, I've got to do something for exercise," and so I picked up a pamphlet on the sun salutation and a few yoga exercises. And every day, up to that point, I'd been a jock and thought yoga was for weenies, you know. But I started doing yoga every day on the deck. I get to Nassau. I take up my binoculars. I look at Paradise Island, and Vishnu Devananda has an ashram there. I get in my dinghy. I sail over. He says, "Hello," and I don't do a good Indian accent, which is a drag because it's such a great accent, but he says, "Hello, I had a dream of sailing around the world without a passport as a peace mission. It might have been your ship. It looks familiar." We had an 80-foot Baltic trader, 60 years old. He said, "You and your friends," I was the first one over there, "are welcome to take all the meditation classes, yoga classes, etc., you want while you make up your mind whether we should do this." So at that moment, I began to do an hour and a half of yoga in the morning, an hour and a half of yoga in the afternoon, and before the yoga in the morning, an hour of meditation. The yoga stuck. I still do it to this day. The meditation did not until I was going through a divorce. I was just about to go through a divorce. It was that point where things were bad.
And I
turned to meditation through Herbert Benson. In other words, it wasn't the religious piece. It was I picked up the relaxation response, which to some extent is the same thing you're talking about, that one of the things that you were studying was how do we recover from stress. And so that was about 1985, and I have meditated ever since. But I have never done a 3-day, a 10-day, one of those intensive retreats. And the reason I set all that up is that altered traits, and the title is very intentional on your part and Richie's part. It's, can your brain actually have altered traits, not just states that are temporary, but traits that have, that last? And you say that there's something that we were just talking about the benefits you get from immediate or short term or a daily practice, but you say that there is a qualitative difference between that and when you go deeper and have a smart practice. There's your setup. Talk about that.
Yes. So, there are kind of two styles of meditating. One is a daily practice, a day job, but you've got like 15 minutes, half hour, you can give to it every morning or every night. Lots and lots of people do that, and it does have real benefits. But the benefits are kind of amped up or turbocharged if you go away on a long retreat, you know, a week or 10 days or... I just talked to this guy at Google. He did a month.
Wow. And that's a guy at Google.
This guy took a sabbatical and did
something. Okay.
But anyway, he found a way to do it. Yeah. And the data seems to be that the brain changes get deeper. And one of the things that happens in a good retreat is what you call smart practice. It's where you get feedback from an experienced teacher about what to do next, about what would improve your practice. And people seem to make more progress when they do that, and it's true in any domain of expertise, you know, sports. There are professional singers who have coaches all their career for that reason. So and also there's a dose-response relationship, Terrence. So the brain changes get stronger with longer-term practice. You know, people that do up to thousands of hours over a lifetime, that we're able to look at Olympic-level meditators. Davidson convinced some yogis to fly over one by one to his brain lab and be scanned. And the title, Altered Traits, refers to the fact that it's not just what happens during the meditation session, but what the lasting changes are that seem to be most consequential. For the yogis, one of them was really astounding. That is, has to do with what's called the gamma wave. When you have a great idea, insight, breakthrough, solve that problem, you've been working with, you know, over and over, your brain shows a very large amplitude EEG wave called gamma. It doesn't show up ordinarily, but gamma lasts for about a half second. And it goes with this special experience. But the yogis turned out to have gamma in their brainwave all the time. And that suggests that their brains actually are very different and that the practice has brought them to a new level of consciousness, if you will, a true altered trait.
So for me, one more time, gamma is something which will show up in an instrument, but what we believe it means in the brain is what?
It shows up at the moment you have that insight. You solve the creative problem.
Ah.
Or it even shows up when you're vividly imagining biting into a peach. And there's one moment when your brain brings together the taste, the smell, the texture, the sound, all of that. And you get a gamma for a quarter second. Otherwise, it doesn't show up.
Oh, so it is something, I'm thinking when, you look at your infant child and you get a certain smile, boom, it happens. You solve a problem, it happens. You realize something you've been working hard to figure out. So it's a momentary experience, and what you're saying is these yogis live there?
Live there, and they're in a much more intense experience of it than we get for that quarter second. They do describe an ongoing awareness, which is very spacious, very present, very pleasant, and we can only guess, but it sounds pretty good to me.
Yeah. Okay, so we've got about four more minutes.
Sure.
The things that your short version of what you learned researching this book, you learned certain things which have been hyped, science doesn't corroborate, but this thing about smart practice and the sort of the quantum leaps of, I heard you in another interview, you said, if long-term meditators did a day of meditation, say 6 hours, they would receive down-regulation of the genes for inflammation. So someone who's been doing it daily as I have but has never done a full day or a full 3 days, there is a major leap that makes it more of a trait change than just a state experience. For folks who are out there, can you talk a bit about that? So it's what did you learn that doesn't work and just a little more about what does work?
Well, there's a lot of I don't want to say hype, but over exaggeration of the impact of meditation on the brain, and I think that may not be true. I don't follow the hype. I feel that people who are marketing mindfulness to business or just to folks and monetizing it often make claims that just aren't supported by the data. But what is supported by the data, as you mentioned, is that for people who have done serious meditation, there's a benefit that no one expected, which is genomic, and that is that a day, actually 6 hours of meditation continuously down-regulates the inflammatory genes in the body. That means they go quiet. And in genomic science, they're realizing that it's how we turn our genes on and off that matters more than what genes we have. And this is why people who, for example, are born with a gene that's related to a cancer or to a disease may never get that cancer or disease because they never turn the genes on long enough to matter. So when it shows that meditation for just part of a day quiets those genes, that's quite stunning. No one that, in genomic science expected that. But now that we know it, the next follow-up study would be, what happens with people who do this a lot, who do it regularly or go on retreats regularly? What happens at the genetic level? And we're also seeing at the neural level, one of the interesting findings is that long-term meditation seems to slow the aging of the brain. at my age, I'm very interested in that finding.
Yeah.
But at any age, it's pretty good.
And also, I was just going to say that the one you mentioned before about inflammation, they have been the other on a parallel track. They've been finding that inflammation is a much more serious cause of so many debilitating things in our health. So that when you slow inflammation, you are at a sort of an upstream point where you're really affecting your health.
Yeah. So the next study would be to find out, well, is this a clinically meaningful change?
Yes.
Maybe it is. Maybe it's not. Maybe
and how long does it?
For
how
some
long?
Things and not others.
You say do yes. six. You've been meditating for a couple of years, 15 minutes a day. Now you do 6 hours. Now you have this downregulation of inflammation. How long does that last?
We don't know. That's the next study that needs to
okay.
be done.
Okay. Great. And this actually brings me to my sort of last question, which is, what are the questions you're hot about pursuing right now?
I'd like to know at what age you can start kids. I did teach 1 5-year-old to meditate. He was wearing a Batman costume. I said, you know how Batman got his powers? That kid, this 5-year-old sat breath without moving for about a half hour. Blew me away. And I think that we underrate kids' ability to do this. We just have to pitch it to them the right way. And I'd like to know what difference that makes. I think it would make a huge difference over the course of a life. I think that in the book we describe, 20 areas that need further follow-up. I mentioned a couple, like the gene finding. Does it matter clinically, and does it last beyond the session, or how much does it take to last? And can this be used for delaying or deferring the onset of degenerative brain disease? Can it be used to make people more compassionate? Can be used for activists. A lot of social activists burn out.
Yes.
Because they don't know how to metabolize the anger and the stress. But really, as the Dalai Lama says, you want to be composed. You want to be able to calm down and see clearly. And he says, analyze deeply. Look at the social systemic causes of all this. Where really can you make the most difference? And then once you know that, act. Do something. Mm-hmm. Whatever your particular ability to act may be.
Okay. So the book is Altered Traits, Science Reveals How Meditation Changes Your Mind, Brain, and Body by today's guest, Daniel Goleman, and Richard J. Davidson.
Yes.
And
that's right.
The websites are danielgoleman.info. That's D-A-N-I-E-L, Daniel Goleman, without a D.
Right.
G-O-L-E-M-A-N, danielgoleman.info, and healthyminds.org. Thank you, Daniel Goleman. Keep up the good work.
Thanks, Terrence. Likewise.
So for this conversation and many other interviews, articles, transcripts, join me in pursuit of a world that just might work. Go to terrencemcnally.net or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcements of upcoming guests and issues and probably 5 or 6 articles that are relevant to that issue and to that week, sign up at my site or email me at temcnally, T-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y @mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on iTunes. You can find years of podcasts at my site, terrencemcnally.net, or at iTunes. Thanks to G, my engineer, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all to you, my listeners. Please share this podcast widely.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises.
For WIN, I'm Joanne Powers. Following last week's narrow defeat of a unionization drive, the Korean-owned Kumho Tire plant in Macon, Georgia, has fired Mario Smith, one of the leaders in the push to form a union. The United Steelworkers have filed an unfair labor practice charge with the National Labor Relations Board challenging the firing. USW Organizing Director Maria Soma sees Smith's firing as a continuation of the company's union-busting intimidation campaign.
Mario was very outspoken in support of the union and spoke to many of his co-workers about what he believed to be the benefits. And as a direct result of that, the company targeted him specifically for illegal termination post-election. So my first feeling is one of sorrow for Mario. The second one is of outrage against the company for continuing to union bust.
Soma says they will continue to fight to protect workers at the plant.
If an employer is going after a worker, even after an election drive, we will protect those workers for as long as we need to for standing up for their legal rights to form a union. We believe that we lost that election due to the employer's illegal behavior. We had a supermajority of support going into it and only lost support as the employer performed psychological warfare on these workers by forcing them into captive audience meetings for 1 to 2 hours every single day, every single shift, making threats against the plant, the business, and individual workers.
A recent study from the Economic Policy Institute finds that while municipal governments are increasingly trying to pass labor and employment improvements, more conservative state governments are pushing them back down. Since the beginning of 2016, 15 states have passed 28 laws preempting local labor standards on everything from minimum wage to paid leave, fair scheduling, prevailing wages, and project labor agreements. Marnie Von Wilpert is Associate Labor Counsel with EPI.
We've seen conservative corporate-backed lobbying groups such as ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, really start pushing this again in 2013 with its Model Living Wage Preemption Act to prevent any municipality from raising the minimum wage. We're seeing it really skyrocket. So it is a bit ironic that once local control actually starts to take hold, conservative forces are now trying to crush it.
In August, the state of Missouri dropped the minimum wage in St. Louis from $10 an hour back down to $7.70.
Fight for 15 were some of the biggest backers of raising the minimum wage in St. Louis, and they were successful. They won. But then the state government took it all away. And so if workers who want to do grassroots campaigns on the ground in these very conservative areas, their last hope is the cities. Now we're finding that that's being pulled out from under us.
The NAACP has filed suit against the state of Alabama, citing racial animus when it shut down a minimum wage increase in the primarily black city of Birmingham.
We're seeing this all throughout the country, that primarily white legislators from richer areas in the state are putting these preemption bills on the cities, which have a lot higher rates of poverty and more people of color. And so it's really a whole racial dynamic, too, that we have to see, an economic justice dynamic.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit workersindependentnews.com.